Afternoon, everybody. Thank you for joining us for what is almost the last session of the day. And we were rather fearful, given that it was getting late, that with the drinks starting in half an hour or so, we would see a small audience. But we're actually delighted to see so many people here. My name is Trevor Watkins. I'm the global head of sport at Pinsent Masons. My first declaration is I'm actually a Bournemouth supporter. So I would have been talking about the Football League in any event this season, but we're in the Premier League for the first time ever. However, I remember when my dad took me when I was 7 years old to watch Bournemouth play. For every year since, apart from this season, it was to see them as a Football League club. So the Football League is very close to my heart. I'm delighted that we've got a great panel that are going to be looking at a range of issues about what it is to be in the Football League, what it is to be the Football League, and what the future might hold for one of the world's leading football competitions. Sean Harvey, the CEO to my left. Sean has got a long, detailed background within football and is never shy of opinion, but from your time as Leeds United CEO and now in running this organisation. Mark Browning, ITN Productions, now a very key partner of the Football League and doing some fantastic stuff within football and sport generally. Paul Barber, CEO of Brighton and Hove Albion Football Club, and again with a tremendous background, having been at Spurs, Vancouver, and will bring an insight from what it means to be top of the championship of the Football League at the moment, although he keeps telling me that is going to jinx the whole season. And at the very end, Nick Sykes, branding expert, Future Brands, who again are a key partner of the Football League and beginning to do some very exciting work with them as a competition. We have got 43 minutes and 27 seconds to debate and hopefully bring out some key issues. We can't see you that well because the lights are shining down, but I'm told there are microphones out there, so we'll be delighted to take questions on most subjects. I'll act as moderator on that, but hopefully to get some great debate. But, I mean, first of all, I mean, Sean, I'm going to turn to Paul and say, Paul, you are top of the championship, so we're here to talk about the Football League, but you're desperate to get out of it.
Definitely, yeah. It's a great league, but the prize above us is massive. The competition around us is probably even bigger. So to be top after five games is great, but it would be better to be top after 45 games, preferably 46.
So on a serious note, I mean, Sean, this competition, joking apart, every year you have the opportunity to put three of your members, and I said last season Bournemouth happened to be one of them, into what is seen as the world's most lucrative sporting competition. But you also take members from the conference, national game coming in. Set the scene for us. Football League, give us a few facts and figures about how important it is in the world.
The Football League is actually it's actually 127 years today since the first Football League games were played on the 8th of September. And, you know, it's a truly wonderful competition. It is arguably the most competitive, and it certainly carries the biggest single prize for success. And as you've heard Paul say, you know, the majority of the clubs in the Championship actually want to get out of the Football League. Do they want to get out of the Football League or into the Premier League? Now, we shouldn't look on that as being a weakness. It's actually the strength of the pyramid in this country. And, you know, we listened, and I'm sure many of you have sat here and heard La Liga talk about their plans for marketing expansion, because they want to take on the Premier League. They should try living with the Premier League in their own country. Yet we go toe-to-toe with them every single Saturday in the appeal for fans inside this country. 16.3 million fans came through the turnstiles at Football League clubs last season. Yes, there's 1,651 games. But the reality is, people up and down the country go through our turnstiles to watch what is an absolute wonderful competition. And whilst we look at clubs like Brighton and many of the others in the Championship wanting to leave us to get to the Premier League, we do take three clubs each year from the Premier League back into the Championship. There's no amount of marketing can ever create that level of expectation and actually competition. Equally, below us, the National League, as it's now been rebranded, are providing two clubs each season from the ranks of non-league football to play in the professional game. People ask me why the Football League's vibrant. In 2 minutes, you've just had the answer.
So, Sean, I mean, that's five members changing every year. Roughly speaking, how many clubs have actually gone to the Premier League and come back down now?
Well, I think the most recent statistics with your club, Bournemouth, actually getting promoted, I think there's now been just actually over half the clubs have now played in the Premier League. So that's a sample of how many clubs have actually reached that particular objective. And of course, you can only have 20 in any one season. So ultimately, the numbers will always flux. But that's the actual strength of the competition. You know, that first day of the season, everybody's recruitment goes on about trying to get promotion, whether that's from the Championship to the Premier League, from League One to the Championship, because that's a very significant change now in financial gains. League Two to League One, National League to League Two. The pyramid works, it drives interest, it keeps matters going. And the advent of the playoffs to bring that drama at the end of the season and create the £120 million game is something you cannot actually comprehend when you actually start the season.
And just for the benefit of people from different countries, you run playoffs in each league. You've got three leagues, 24 teams in each league, playoffs in each league.
That's right. So, you know, the top two from the Championship and League One are promoted automatically. It's actually the top three to get promoted automatically from League Two. And the next four teams in the division play in the playoffs. The winner and the finals are played at Wembley over May Bank Holiday weekend, get promotion.
So, Nick, is this a branding nightmare or a branding dream for you?
Well, I think, as Sean has very well expressed, it's branding from a position of huge strength. You know, one of the largest, if not the largest league in the world, a very solid fan base with a great product that's a very exciting product. And in fact, in the course of some of the work we're doing, you look at the unexpected nature of the Football League versus, shall we say, the profession of the Premier League, and it's terribly exciting. And I think the other difference for those of you who were in the last session is, you know, the Football League is not trying to become not the Premier League. It's a very strong thing in its own right. And that's what makes the rebrand very, very exciting for us.
Because you don't just have the league competition, do you? I mean, there's cup competitions.
Yeah, there's the Johnson Paint and the Capital One Cup as well. So, and obviously the playoffs. So there's a degree of properties to look at how they sit with the Football League, how they should be branded, how they should be taken to market, and what jobs they can do in attracting new and interesting audiences.
And Mark, we're going to come to you in terms of looking at what you're doing in technology terms a little bit later on. But as being involved in the broadcast industry, how appealing is the Football League now as a product?
It's the most appealing it's ever been, partly because it's now more available than it's ever been in the way it's being produced. And it's now on a primetime Saturday night channel as well, which just increases the exposure of the brand.
That's the first time ever that it's been this early on a Saturday night. Not 9 o'clock on?
Which benefits both fans and brands and sponsors of the clubs. So if you're a commercial director in a club, you're now on primetime television.
And big impact. Because, I mean, if I'm a fan, when can I see highlights? Are they on pretty quick after the games now, Sean?
Well, I mean, the main highlights program's at 9 o'clock on Channel 5. But the move to Channel 5 from the BBC was seen by some as being a little bit risky. You know, do you take on, you know, do you try and do without the strength of the BBC, the follow-on audience from Match of the Day? But we decided that what we needed to do was to try and take the Football League to a different audience. Ultimately, most people, by the time they get to 40, 45, have probably decided which club it is they're going to support. And there's no amount of external influence is actually going to change that. What we decided we needed to try and achieve was get to a younger generation, actually, in the UK. So how do you do that? Well, what you've got to do is try and get your highlights on free-to-air TV in front of fans before they get to see the Premier League, to give the parents the chance to instill their actual beliefs and the club that they've supported for all the years in front of the younger fans. So the demographic group that's now watching our highlights programme comes from a much younger generation. So that's the generation we decided we needed to work with and influence to keep the Football League strong going forward.
So as far as you're able, in terms of the broadcast deal and what it means for clubs. How does it break down and what sort of sums are we talking about for Championship, League One, League
Well,
Two?
Well, I mean, without getting into the actually individual sums, I mean, our whole arrangement with Sky is worth £88.3 million. So for what some would view as a second-tier competition, that is massively more than any other non-top-tier league actually receives. I mean, our clubs went out and spent £100 million on players during the summer transfer window. That is four times more than any other non-top tier league, and actually a lot more than the majority of top tier leagues. So the Football League has the Premier League in its backyard, yet we have to fight for our audience share. And that's why we've made this very significant change in relation to how we're trying to market the league, brand the league, and how we're going to try and take it forward. We can't stand still. We're strong, but we have to get stronger. And the work that we've done with ITN, with ADI, in actually getting accessibility to our content at the earliest possible opportunity is all part of that longer-term objective.
Yeah, we'll have a look at some of that technology shortly. I mean, Paul, putting aside your current league position, because obviously things go up, things go down, but in terms of this season, we touched on a session yesterday of how big a prize it is for a club that gets into the Premier League next year. Sean's just mentioned this £100 million that's been spent on players. Must be difficult with Premier League aspirations in terms of trying to balance budgets. And how did you find the last transfer window?
Oh, it's tough. I mean, it's a very competitive market. The price of players continues to rise. The cost of agents continues to rise. Cost of wages generally continues to rise, so it's tough. And obviously in the Championship we're competing against 7, 8, 9 clubs who have got parachute payments from their previous time in the Premier League, which makes it tougher still. But you know, there are very many different ways of getting to the Premier League. Bournemouth are a good example. You know, they didn't have the biggest budgets, they haven't got the biggest ground, they don't have the best training facilities, but they're sitting in the Premier League, so it's possible. Burnley before them, Blackpool before them. So, you know, we know that money doesn't buy success, guarantee success. It helps, but it doesn't guarantee. What we have to do is to put ourselves in the best possible position in terms of infrastructure, the best squad that we can assemble, the best coaches that we can recruit, and also to make sure that our academy is bringing through good young players for the future as well, to bridge that gap between the biggest budgets and those that haven't got those. But it's a hugely competitive league, and the Championship week in, week out will produce surprises in a way that perhaps other leagues around the world just don't. And that's a credit to the competition and a credit to the Football League. And, you know, we all say how desperate we are to get out of the Championship, but arguably it's far more exciting than any other league that I've certainly worked in.
And I think certainly last season when Bournemouth did get promoted, yes, it was hugely exciting, or going right down to the wire. So for you, in terms of Brighton, you've got a new stadium. How long has that been open now?
This is our fifth season.
And average home gate?
Last year was around 26,000, yeah.
So it's reaching a huge amount of the local catchment area and population. What's the biggest sort of challenge for you now, Paul?
I think the biggest challenge is just the sheer competitiveness of the league. And, you know, there are no guarantees. We've got good crowds, we've got good sponsors, we've got a great stadium, a new training ground, but that doesn't guarantee you success. And, you know, we've got 23 competitors in our league that want the same thing as us. And that means that every single game that we play, whether we're sitting in first place or 24th place, is a highly competitive 90 minutes of football. And, you know, at the end of the day, it's a very, very long road that we're on. I mean, it's a cliche in football to be top after 5 games is nice. And people like you, Trevor, keep jinxing it, and we may not be there in 40 games' time. But the reality is that, you know, every single team in our division, bar maybe one or two that are looking to consolidate having been promoted, are challenging for promotion. And that's what makes this competition such a good one.
I think it's certainly what we're seeing when you talk to the Premier League clubs is that, aside from the top 5 or 6, there's only a limited number in the Premier League now that are really aspirational about getting into that top level. So it does make the Championship exciting. But Nick, for you, you're working with the whole league. Yes. And you're working with all 72 yep. clubs. How difficult is it to balance the interests of an Oxford United with a Plymouth, with a Brighton, with a Millwall?
I mean, I think it goes beyond that, actually. So when you're looking at a branding exercise, you know, a brand is obviously not a logo. Logo is just but one manifestation of that brand. And one of the complexities of the Football League is you obviously have the clubs, but then you have the fans, you then have the football family, you then have the sponsors, you then have the players, and actually the job is to balance and to find something that works across all of those audiences. You know, and if you look at some of the most successful and, by definition, some of the most unsuccessful rebrands, not just in sport but in commerce as well, understanding your different audience needs is probably the most important thing to do when undertaking a rebranding. So if you're in the UK, many years ago, everyone remembers Consignia, that famous rebranding of the Royal Mail that crashed and burned within about 18 months after it was announced, you know, at vast cost and at vast reputational damage. So, you know, we have a great thing to do, and we need to balance those different and disparate needs when looking at how to rebrand the Football League.
And when you compare that to the Premier League, it seems like a very different entity. I know the point was made before we came out about the Premier League being different in terms of what's more important, the clubs or the league itself.
Sure. Well, also, it's smaller, isn't it? You know, you've only got to worry about 20... You've got 20 partners or 20 clients in you know, Sean's role. He's got 72 that he has to worry about. So there is... It's also properly national. I mean, if you look at the Premier League, it's mainly based in the big conurbations rather than the smaller cities. So arguably it's a much more simple thing, and because of the massive deals that they had, they're able to sort of buy their way into primetime telly. So if you look at some of the other things that sort of comes under brand strategy, if you look at the Channel 5 deal, it's really interesting. How does a football league, if you like, punch above its weight and get noticed and go head-to-head with the Premier League with a fraction of the money and a fraction of the muscle?
And for you, Sean, before we move on to looking at the technology and the broadcast that Mark's been working on, how difficult is it? I mean, I've sat those tables where you have division by division having a vote on what should or shouldn't happen. How difficult is it to manage 72 very different clubs?
Well, the 72 clubs of different sizes, you know, all of which have got one real common aim. They want to do as well as they can. Not everybody can be successful. So, obviously, managing 72 clubs is a lot easier if you're delivering good and positive news. If you're not delivering good and positive news, it is always more of a challenge. And usually football clubs are owned by individuals who, by definition, have been successful in their own specialist field of business. Not many of them are used to actually being told what it is that they should actually do. So not only is there 72 clubs, you've got 72 very different characters that actually run these clubs. You've got those that are for a collective, and then you've got the radical members as well. So actually finding a middle ground is actually the biggest challenge. And as I say, it gets easier if you're delivering positive news. But you've got to take clubs on a journey with you. You can't always get things right. You can't always deliver increased revenue. You can't always deliver increased audience figures. At some stage, you have to manage expectation. And I think what we're trying to do is, if we've been taking clubs on an absolute journey with us as to what we're trying to achieve, and actually getting them to buy into the strategy behind our objectives rather than just the final result, actually does help ease that path. But it's certainly not easy. And as many people have turned around and say, how do you manage 72 clubs? Well, the answer is day to day, you know, and ultimately sometimes the outcome actually manages where you have to take the discussion. And, you know, in doing that, if you're successful, we'll carry on growing. And that's the objective.
So we'll come back to some of the finance a little bit later on. But Mark, for you, from a broadcast perspective, dealing with the clubs and the solutions you've been providing, at a general level, have you found a different sort of approach from each club, or have...
Well, so far we're 5 weeks in, and just for the benefit of those who don't understand the difference, the old model was a camera operator on a gantry filming a game with a tape or a card in their camera, and then they'd finish the game and they'd get in their car and they'd load up their kit and they'd drive somewhere and they'd get it out and they'd load it into another machine and then they'd start editing it, and it was 3 hours later, and then they'd send it to someone else, and then it might arrive at the broadcaster by 9, 10, 11 o'clock at night, and clubs following that. So, for example, the footage now is available on Sky, and the goals are available on Sky as they're happening. And the difference to what we've introduced, and the reason we're in this space as a news organisation is it's very similar. It's connecting multiple feeds, telling stories, doing it live, doing it fast. Is the camera operator now on a gantry, plugs in a cable to the ADI dark fibre network, which is highly secure and resilient, and that footage is in real time available. So the editing now and the footage now is done remotely and real, and is available in real time for stakeholders to get hold of. So that completely changes the ecosystem and the commercial model.
So 3 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon, Brighton Hove Albion are playing. You've got your people there, they're filming, and that content is there to be used.
Well, it's not available. It's there in real time. It's not. There's a restriction on when stuff's available because of
course,
the rights.
Subject to restrictions.
But yeah, in principle, it's available to whoever wanted it at that point. What's changed is that footage isn't literally moving around. If we fire up what's on the screens, you will see in a booth outside in the auditorium area, there is a film crew filming a stand. If you want to put it on the screens, that would help us, if it's there. And the footage from this auditorium is now going from those two cameras that are in this auditorium out of this building to a data centre. This person here, you can see that we're on that screen, is not editing footage on his machine. He's editing footage from these two cameras that has gone to a data center. And he's doing that in real time. And that, if you imagine, from a sports rights perspective, completely changes. It vastly reduces cost, it rapidly increases time, and it makes available new commercial opportunities.
So this data, how many games do you roughly cover?
All the games. So on a Boxing Day with the Premier League, we're doing it, it'd be 50 OBs.
So 50 outside broadcasts, simultaneous coverage being uploaded. Mm-hmm. And that is then used by Channel 5.
Well, it allows the rights owner to have a deal that is in prime time. It allows the clubs and the fans to be able to access footage in real time. And what it really does is it gives, in this case, the league, it empowers them to take control of their rights and their content. And they now have the control over that, and they can decide what deals they do, who they do them with, and when they do them. And it's completely changed the commercial model, because you're not having to lumber around kit, you're not having to have as much kit, you're not having to have as many people. You can see one person there. I mean, it's in many ways, it's low tech. It's a machine that looks at a data center, sees footage, and edits it and stacks it up. It's files. And those files are available and digital and can be moved to any part of the country at any time.
So for you, Sean, this flexibility, is it beginning to pay dividends?
Well, we're 5 weeks in to the actual channel, with the Channel 5 show, but that's just the beginning. And we've talked about how we look to try and promote ourselves on a domestic and on a national basis. What we've got to get ourselves really comfortable with is how we can use this in making our games available overseas. You know, the Football League has traditionally been a domestic product. You know, most people have, you know, our biggest fan bases, we don't get fans coming from overseas unless they're expats or they've actually got a connection that they've formed with a club over a period of years. So what can we actually do overseas? This technology would allow us to actually stream games, subject to all the rights, overseas, actually at the time they are being played. So we could actually widen our stadiums to the actual computer screens all the way around the world. What additional income does that generate for the Football League? That's the actual process that we're going of evaluation that we're going through at the moment. So we will get our games in front of fans across the world before anybody else does on this particular basis.
So for you, Paul, as a club, this whole new digital era with the Football League moving towards new platforms, other new agreements will come in the next few years. How important and what ways are you looking to exploit your content further?
Well, it's vitally important because sponsors essentially are looking for two key ingredients. One is exposure, second thing's audience. So the more exposure we can give them and the bigger audience we can deliver, potentially the more valuable the sponsorship programme, which for Football League clubs is a very different ball game than what we've previously experienced. The Premier League obviously has a fantastic platform to worldwide exposure. We haven't had that in the same way. I think the other thing for us with the benefit of the fibre network is the ability to beam back games, we have a nightmare programme which Sean and his team manage superbly. 46 games in a 52-week year, plus cup games, plus the weeks that we don't play, gives you at least two games a week. And, if you're in Brighton and you've got to try and get to Huddersfield on a Tuesday night, it's not easy. But equally, it's not easy for the league's fixtures people to try and give everybody a close game on a Tuesday night. So we have to cope with that. The ability to have reciprocal beanback arrangements where fans can stay in their own city but still enjoy watching their team play with a high-quality feed is a commercial asset, and we can actually monetize that, and we can actually start to drive revenue from that as well. And provided the host club isn't being damaged in any way by people not turning up to the game, and broadcasters not affected because there are not enough people at the game to create the right atmosphere, these are assets that we haven't really had before. And I think we'll start to change the nature of the way that the league operates and the way fans enjoy it.
So, Sean, I need
to... Yeah, just to follow up on an actual real example. Leeds United went to play at Bristol City. The allocation of tickets was 1,300 due to the redevelopment at Ashton Gate, which is another big city club making real stadium developments to grow. They were always going to sell the 1,300 tickets, so they were able to beam the game back to the facilities at Elland Road, and it was watched by another 1,200. Now, there are relatively... those numbers are significant in terms of, fans wanting to support their clubs, and all that's possible because of the arrangements that we now have in place, and we are only at the start of the journey.
Mark,
Just to pick up on Sean's point, streaming is one part, but what this enables the commercial opportunity is to slice and dice these rights, not just by territory but by type of footage. So it might be short form 30-second goals, it might be 5-minute highlights, it might be 15-minute versions, then it might be streaming, and that's then split by territory as well. And you can instantly see that whether it's subscription models or overseas rights, a significant number of fans who are passionate about their club will pay, will subscribe, whether it's a short-form goal, real-time footage or streaming. And that, I think, presents a whole new world. The investment that the league have made and other federations would choose to make opens up a commercial opportunity that's not there at the moment.
So for you, actually, just in terms of your business, this pioneering example sets a scene that you're hoping other competitions will follow.
What the league have done, and they've got first mover advantage, is the investment that they've made will give them new revenue opportunities as they choose to do it. But what it's interesting for smaller federations, governing bodies, or sports themselves, take hockey or netball or what have you. At the moment, they would perceive quite rightly that it's television, it's hugely expensive, we can't do it, it's out of our range. Actually, it's not. With a moderate degree of investment, this kind of technology that you were seeing there instantly opens up a market that is untapped at the moment for sports that feel it's out of their particular financial position. And I think that's going to be interesting to see who goes into that space, whether it's hockey or netball or golf or swimming, because the technology is already in place.
Nick, from a sponsor's perspective, and when you're working with major brands, and you've dealt with some of the biggest companies in the world, the importance to them of this new way of being able to get involved?
Well, I think it opens up many, many new audiences. I think in the UK, in the first quarter of this year, for the first time, more people are getting content on their mobile device than their laptops or screens than they've ever done before. Suddenly, short form goals, little 5-second or 5-minute packages, I can watch it on my smartphone. I'm 18, 19, and that's what I'm doing. I'm not waiting for BBC One at 10 o'clock to watch some highlights or midnight before. So I think it just opens up the Football League to being a modern brand, understanding of its audience's needs. So going back to that thing about how do we create a brand that is relevant for young people today, that in turn, they're the most valuable audiences that sponsor wants. Therefore, sponsors are going to be prepared to pay more. And so it sort of becomes a virtuous circle. And I think it's interesting that you talk about first mover advantage. One of the archetypal traits of challenging brands is that they have a very clear sense of their future. And I think, you know, I think it's a very exciting departure, if you like.
Presumably you're seeing sponsors looking for more incisive, intuitive ways of engaging.
They are, and they're moving beyond eyeballs. So it always used to be about, right, I've got 16.5 million eyeballs. Actually, they're now interested in how they can disseminate their own content to the audiences. And these types of packages or allowing people to access in real-time football allows them to associate their content with that as well. So it opens up a whole world of opportunities for sponsors, you know, beyond just being a title sponsor or a perimeter or a shirt. And as I say, you know, they're all falling over themselves to see how they can get their content to new and interesting audiences.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, you can hear we're all massively excited about where we're taking the Football League and what we're trying to do. But there has to be a balance, because the actual beauty of the Football League actually takes place inside the stadium on a Saturday afternoon. This, everything you're hearing us talking about is expanding the potential and the exposure of the Football League and our clubs. The single biggest area of income generation, however, for the Football League clubs still comes through the paying audience at the turnstiles. So we always have this very difficult balance. The technology is great. It is going to give us opportunities that we couldn't previously perceive. But one of the actual things that we're looking to underwrite is actually the attendance inside the stadium. So we want to expose people to the Football League for the sole with the purpose of driving them through the turnstiles. Our clubs last year took £213 million through their turnstiles. You heard the TV deal at £88.3 million. We can't survive without a TV deal. But what our clubs certainly can't do with is without fans going through the turnstiles. So we have to link the two. It's about growing and then directing individuals to their own clubs.
And this is on the premise that all of us here, whether it's Southampton supporters, Brighton, Chelsea, Leeds or Bournemouth, that we probably all supported those clubs from when we were very young. And if you can get that loyalty at the outset, you're going to keep the fan.
I think it's also important, Trevor, that the broadcasters want there to be a live audience as well. You know, there's nothing worse than a televised game from an empty stadium.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, the more we can do as clubs to get as many people through our turnstiles as we can, the better it is for us, the better it is for the broadcasters, the better it is for the audience that's watching at home. It becomes a virtuous circle. And certainly, you know, from our point of view, we don't rely on the broadcast income. We can't. But equally, we know how important it is to have that broadcast income. So we work as hard to accommodate the broadcasters, but we work even harder to get people through the door.
And do you find that, as fans, that there's an insatiable desire? The more and more content you can provide, the more and more things you can give, the more they get taken up?
Yeah, I think so.
Is that you're seeing, Mark?
This is why I think this is an incremental opportunity for new markets. Because, of course, big stadium, full stadium, gives broadcasters what they need. But there's people who can't get to stadium, who aren't in the country. And this sort of thing opens, and that is an untapped market.
It's interesting. We're working with a European entity that has been picking up the streaming rights to major leagues because they see exactly that market and the model is showing exponential growth. But what keeps you awake at night, Sean, apart from the football world? What is it that you worry about?
Some of the things that worry you are the actual really are the smallest parts. You know, what worries me is the financial health of some of our clubs. Now, we've made some massive strides forward. It's nearly 900 days since we actually had a club go into administration, whereas previously it was a club every 2 or 3 months. Now, that's through a combination of improved financial governance, but also the owners, shareholders, investors in our club continuing to support the club that they have backed for whatever the purpose of that investment. So keeping clubs in business and strong is one of them. And I suppose, the other real challenge, unfortunately it's not hit England in any way, shape or form, there's been allegations, is that football and the Football League in particular
will lose its appeal if fans coming through the turnstiles cannot ever genuinely believe what they see on the pitch is real. So we're talking about the allegations historically of match fixing. It is the one thing that, if it ever is exposed, has been real, could have a real material effect and damage on our game. Fortunately, and I've been involved in football clubs for 22 years, there is that many different people involved. I think the chances of it happening are small. However, the net effect, if it did happen, would be so great that we would never allow complacency to get in the way of ensuring that the product is always genuine. You know, players will always slip and, you know, let a forward through to score a goal. Somebody will always miss an open goal. And fans in this country at this moment in time turn around and say, "Blimey, he should have done a little bit better there." There is never the suggestion that anything else was afoot. So the things that keep me awake at night, potentially, first of all, keeping clubs in business, and secondly, keeping the product genuine.
Taking up your first point, are you disappointed that, perhaps you can't comment, just the rules have changed and the financial rules have been slightly relaxed, allowing clubs to spend a bit more to chase that promotion dream?
You mean our financial fair play rules?
Yeah.
I don't think I'm disappointed, because ultimately those changes were put into place in consultation with the clubs. And, you know, as long as owners are prepared to support and back their clubs, which they are doing, then there has to be a limit. But ultimately, as long as we're satisfied that the clubs are actually sustainable, then that's the way forward. I mean, the other thing too, we talked about a competitive nature of the Football League and the Championship in particular, you know, because we've been focusing on, you know, where Paul and Brighton are at this moment in time, is that the actual Premier League want to see a competitive Championship. They don't want certainty at the start of any one season which three clubs are going to get promoted. They want to see a door which brings new clubs. You know, they were absolutely delighted when Bournemouth got promoted. It's a new club to the radar. It brings something else. It gives them another opportunity. And that's one of the reasons why, through a solidarity agreement, which is now contracted with the Premier League, the Football League will benefit from approximately £100 million.
Okay, just so people know, that's an agreement that's legally binding between you and the Premier League.
Absolutely. So any club who is not in receipt of a parachute payment receives a significant payment from the Premier League. Ultimately, the figures aren't known exactly as yet, because it will be based and completed when the Premier League have sold their next lot of international rights. But ultimately, that will be worth £100 million to our clubs. You know, now, I obviously hope they don't go out and blow that all on transfer fees and new players, and it'd be a good job, well done if they don't. But the bottom line is, it gives everybody a chance, and that's one of the reasons why we increased the actual amount, to give clubs the real opportunity to be able to invest for the future.
And so, from your perspective, presumably it's a good thing if a Football League club gets promoted and stays in the Premier League.
Absolutely. I mean, we don't necessarily want to be seeing the same clubs going up and down, up and down, up and down, because actually that will do nothing for our competition. Because the dream of gaining promotion has to be real.
So, Paul, you got a 1 in 24 chance. Well, no, 1 in 8 chance, because three teams will get promoted. This January transfer window, and I'm not asking you to speak specifically about Brighton, but if I was a club owner and I've got the prospect of £120 million, they're saying, for the bottom club in the Premier League next season, do you fear that a club that's 6th, 7th, 8th, we're going to see huge inflations in transfer values, clubs spending lots of money or trying to spend lots of money?
I think it was ever thus in January, because you've got clubs that are chasing a dream and clubs that are trying to protect their position. So the January transfer window is always one of those tricky ones, as Sean knows from running a club as well, where, you know, you're looking at your position and you're thinking, well, maybe just one more player will get us to the promised land, or maybe one more player will keep us where we are and we'll go again next season. But the great thing about football, and it's always been the case, is that every season the dream starts again, and you feel that you've got as good a chance in the summer as anyone else, and therefore you go for it. But January is usually the time when people are, you know, going for it if they can.
And the reality is, I've got more than three big spending clubs, so more, at least one is going to be disappointed. Let's hope it's not Brighton.
Let's hope so. You've all jinxed it, really, honestly. I wish I hadn't come. Terrible.
On that point, we've got about 5 minutes to go, and I think there are some microphones. We can carry on talking for ages on subjects here, but 5 minutes. Is there any questions out there in the audience? Can we actually see any hands? There are microphones roaming, I believe. Oh, there's a question and a phone. There's a lady asking a question here. Oh, is there a microphone or are we... There's a lady down here.
Oh, hi, Sean.
Hello.
Simon Austin.
That's lady with a deep voice, that is.
It's clearly not the lady in the front, anyway.
All right. The fit and proper person test has been a big story for you. Are you satisfied that test is fit for purpose? And are there any ways that you would change the way it's like policed and enforced? Well, so we're thinking of Massimo Cellino at Leeds, Carson Young at Birmingham.
We can't obviously talk about specifics, but...
I mean, Simon, the Football League's fit and proper persons test, or the owners and directors test, as it's known now, which, just for the avoidance for anybody who hasn't got your same level of knowledge about it, is ultimately exactly the same as it is in the Premier League. Is that what it is? It's an eligibility test. Is about can somebody pass a test which is strict in terms of its interpretation to run a football club? It goes across any number of different criteria. So it's a self-declaration against somebody's past. What we don't know is how many people the owners and directors test has actually put off from buying clubs. All we ever hear about are the ones that are actually in the game, whose credentials people are going to question. So, ultimately, the test is what the test is. It's one of eligibility. What we've done to supplement that in more recent years, of course, is actually look at the sustainability of investors into clubs to ensure that they have actually got the finance available to run that club. And we spend a lot longer now looking at future financial information and source and sufficiency of funding than we do actually can somebody pass the test. So the two things are actually done in conjunction. They can always be strengthened, they can always be done better. But I've seen some owners and directors test come through where I felt, cool, I'm not so sure. They're running clubs, football clubs today and doing it really well. So there's no sort of blinkered approach, or there's no DNA that actually says they would be a good owner, they would be a bad owner. It genuinely does come to how they perform when they're in the role.
Because you've got the situation with Cellino, haven't you, where it could be every few months this is coming up again.
Well, there's a set of criteria, and there are certain events that could lead to a disqualifying condition, at which stage an individual, not just Mr. Cellino, anybody wouldn't be able to run a football club. So it will keep happening. But that's what the test's there for. The test is there to ensure that ultimately those running their football club are capable of passing that test, and that test is the one that's been approved by the football authorities in this country.
Right, can we move on to another question? Lady in the second row now.
What was the resolution of QPR not paying their fine for breaking the financial fair play rules?
We cannot going to comment on that because that's under legal process, and I said on behalf of the panel I wouldn't put them in that position, so I'm afraid we can't discuss that. Question, second row here.
Hi, James Green, Kantar Sport. I was just wondering how closely are you related to Channel 5 and their showcase of your product, and do you work together to best showcase that product?
Mark, perhaps answer that one.
Well, we're the production partner for the Football League, and the Football League have a contract with Channel 5 as a broadcaster. Our commitment is to produce the footage and to get it to whoever, all the stakeholders, Sky, the production partner for Channel 5, and others. So that's the way the relationship is structured. We have a contract with the Football League as their production partner.
But to answer the question very quickly, we work closely with Channel 5. I mean, there's a weekly meeting that takes place between the members of staff. You will have seen some of the editorial changes from show 1 to show 5. The fact that Channel 5 committed to actually putting the show on with just League 1 and League 2 games this weekend over the International Week is something that has never happened before. And it's there to show the depth and breadth of the Football League. So it's definitely work in progress, but it's work that we're confident is going to get us to an end result that we can all be proud of.
Gentlemen, end of the second row there. You just say who you are and where you're from.
Yeah. Hi, my name is Thomas. I'm from Ticket Beast in Spain. I'm kind of a football freak, and I watch the championship because I'm a football Fulham supporter. So it's a really exciting product, okay? I really congratulate you for that. My question is not about business related, but would you agree if I say that you can actually see more genuine British football in the championship than in the Premiership? Because nowadays you see like the Premiership is more like a Spanish kind of football, but in the championship you can see direct football, crosses into the area, wingers. Will you agree with that? Or
so, Paul, is this a traditional British football in the championship these days?
I think it's a variety. I think there are some teams that will play the type of football you're talking about that you'll see in Spain or you'll see in the Premier League, and there are other clubs in the championship because of the players they've got that will play a more direct style. I think, you know, what I enjoy about it is that from one week to the next, it varies. And sometimes in the same game, you'll see various different formations and very different styles of play. So it makes for an exciting game and exciting competition.
Nick, I mean, is this a uniquely British offering you're taking to the world, or a global offering that has a British ingredient?
No, it's a British offering, but we will take it to the world. You know, the Bentley of football.
Any more questions out there? Lady in the middle at the back. We'll have two or three more, and then I'm conscious that people will no doubt be wanting to disappear off.
Hi, I'm Emma Shaw from Couchmans. You were talking about clubs that kind of yo-yo between the Premiership and go back down to the Championship, and they obviously receive parachute payments. Those clubs obviously have a lot more money than sort of certain clubs that are kind of been in the Championship and are kind of stuck there and haven't really had the chance to move up. I'm aware that FIFA have extended the emergency loan system until the end of this season, and they keep extending it season by season. But how do you sort of envisage that when that does come in, will it cause damage to certain clubs that don't have the money to be able to bring in players and they can't loan good talent from Premiership clubs?
So abolition of emergency windows, what's the effect?
So let's have the fact, you've put it forward right. The fact is that there will be no emergency loans after the end of this season. There won't be any further extension. To get the extension for this year, we effectively said that will be the last time that we ask. The reason we got the extension on this basis is that we needed the time to be able to adjust. Now, who is going to be the biggest beneficiary, or indeed the biggest loser, of emergency loans not being available? Is it going to be clubs in the Football League that can't take players in on a short-term basis? Or is it going to be clubs in the Premier League who have got excess players who can't find anybody where for them to play? So there's a real balance. And I actually think one of the things that will pan out over in a period of time, it won't be next season or the season after, is that a number of younger players will have to take a view. Do they want to be footballers and actually appear on a Saturday afternoon? Or do they want to be footballers in a squad who may at some stage play on a Monday lunchtime in a development game? So there's actually a big change coming forward as to how that dynamic's going to work. Personally, I'm not upset that emergency loans are going to disappear. I think there were short-term challenges for some of our clubs to ensure that they start the season with sufficient players. You can still loan players from window to window. So ultimately, I think we're going to see more stable squads, and I actually think more young players will get a chance as a result of it. And coming to our friend from Spain who's talked about, you know, his love for Fulham and Championship football. The Championship isn't second rate in England. It's different to the Premier League. And the opening day of the Football League season, more than 80% of the players in our competition were classed as homegrown. That doesn't mean they're eligible for England. Let's not confuse the two. But ultimately, the opportunities are there. We can create opportunities. What we need is players to see that's the best way to success.
Any more questions? We've got time probably for one more. Well, we've got two hands up, so we'll take them both. Gentleman on the end and then gentleman at the back, and that will be that.
Thank you. Kevin Carpenter, Law in Sport. Mine's a question about striking this delicate balance you were speaking about earlier, about having enough fans in the stadium. And there was a report in The Guardian last week about the hike in Championship, particularly ticket prices over the summer. And it's an issue close to my heart as a Sheffield Wednesday supporter that we were top of that table for our home ticket prices. In order to get enough fans in the stadium, would it ever be considered to talk about some sort of caps for either home fans, away fans, or both, in terms of the amount that could be charged, and for sustainability, and to have enough people coming to the stadiums, because fans are being priced out at the moment.
Are fans being priced out, Brighton?
I can't speak about Sheffield Wednesday. I mean, I think again, there is a balancing act. I mean, you've got to pitch your product in any business at a price that the people you're aiming at can afford to buy. And I think every club's got a responsibility to set those prices at a level where they can fill their stadiums as best they can. But everyone's going to be different. You know, we've invested £125 million in a stadium. We've got great legroom, great seats, fantastic viewing positions, free Wi-Fi, transport's included in the ticket price. You know, we've got to recover that investment somehow. At the same time, our supporters want us to put the best possible team on the pitch, which has got to be paid for. So I think there's always going to be a balancing act between what we can afford to subsidise, if you like, bearing in mind most Championship clubs are losing money, but also making sure that fans can actually afford to come. So every club, I think, has got to make their own decision on that and pitch it at the right level.
One last question. Gentleman there.
Hi, I'm Toby Gray. I'm a student from UCFB. I'm a season ticket holder at Leeds United, and I want to just ask you about the fixture congestion in terms of having, you touched on it earlier, about the beanbag and having midweek away trips at the other side of the country. For example, Leeds going to Bristol City the other week and Fulham away in about a month's time. Was there be ever any consideration in terms of the fixtures when they get released and get prepared of being sort of segmented into regions, like midweek away games will be localised, so to speak, to make it more beneficial for fans?
We have 46 games. So the first thing that's not on the agenda is reducing 46 games, because that would be one of the easiest ways of actually reducing the number of midweek games. But ultimately, I think we all believe that's the optimum number to enable football clubs to try and balance their finances. I think one of the things we've got to remember, and it touches actually on the ticket income question from the gentleman earlier, you know, each club ultimately has a look at its own model. And as you know, there's no club prices tickets where it doesn't believe it can make the maximum amount of income, because it just wouldn't happen. And ultimately, we've had a look with the fixtures working group over many, many years about the issue of, you know, short games, you know, short mileage games midweek against those on a Saturday. And the conclusion that was actually arrived out of a game at Elland Road. One year, Hull City came on a Tuesday night to Elland Road and brought 1,250 fans. On a Saturday, they brought 3,000 with them. Now, when you look at travelling, so that's a short distance over a midweek to a Saturday game where there was a lot more people in the stadium because it was a Saturday from the visiting club. And as you'll know from your supporting of Leeds, and I'll know from 9 years of working there, Leeds' fan base comes from far and wide. So the attendances are always higher at the weekends. So there's actually a positive move to try and keep more local games at weekends. So the flip side of doing that, by definition, means there's longer journeys during the week. But the financial impact of playing games at a distance midweek is less significant when compared against playing local games at weekends. So whilst if you're a fan that wants to travel the length and breadth of the country to all 46 games, it can actually look that you're being penalised for your loyalty. But actually, what's really happening is your club is actually benefiting from local games being played at weekends.
And on that note, what's been a fascinating 50, 60 minutes of discussion from a branding, participating, broadcasting and organisation perspective. I think Football League is exciting. We've heard a lot of deep thoughts. I'm sure the guys will be very happy to chat to anybody who comes down to the front who wants to ask any questions we couldn't do. But for now, please show your appreciation for their contribution. Thank you very much. And I think the drinks are starting at the networking reception. I've been told to mention National Football Museum, England game being broadcast tonight, UEFA 2016, providing the hospitality. Thank you.